Happy Monday to you, Jules. We're back.
Happy it's Monday, the Gab and Gab. Show. How was your weekend?
It was good. It was solid. I'm working on several projects, and I mentioned Happy Monday because I assumed that, you know, Mark Ogden, who'll be joining us later on, I assumed, obviously, given his roots, he'd be a big Happy Mondays guy, and, you know, Stone Roses, that kind of thing, right? So I asked him, what is the most sort of unusual musical act that he was into that we would not associate with his the northern stereotype character that he plays on our podcast? So, do you know what he said?
Chaz and Dave?
No, not quite. No, David Bowie.
Oh, wow.
I would have thought David Bowie would be the opposite of Mark Ogden.
Yeah, me too. That's interesting.
No. There's a rich vein to be mined there. I also have my artifact for the day. Do you want to see it?
Go on.
This is a signed picture.
You showed that already.
No.
2 weeks ago.
Am I getting that old that I showed it already?
Yeah. Oh, my God. You love it so much. You're showing it twice. This is embarrassing.
All right.
I mean,
okay,
come on.
Okay,
I know you love it, but
I have another much cooler artifact, which...
It's okay, not the 1994 World Cup Italy Island ticket, no?
No. This is a piece that I wrote already. Many, many years ago from the Sunday Herald. You'll see that's Nicholas Anelka.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
In like a Star Wars get-up around the time that he was heavily linked with Juventus.
Juventus,
as
yes.
you recall, yes. This is a serious artifact, one of the first big pieces I wrote for the Sunday Herald. Let's start the show with our buddy Alexander Shefrin, the UEFA president, saying, I think stating the obvious, but you know what? People hadn't necessarily said this before. The season may be lost.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's maybe more for him to prepare people, football fans, football clubs, players even, all of that, because I think he probably would have listened to everybody's ideas and options and scenarios and all of this, and then say, hang on a minute, it's good. And we have our own plan at UEFA. We could start mid-May, we could start start of June, or we could start at the end of June and still manage to play our games. Or, let's be realistic here, also, there might not be any more football for this season at all. And then we start again the 2021 season in September, October, November, whenever. And maybe it was quite clever. I thought it was quite clever from him to say, we also have a structure in place already. We've got our plans. But more importantly, we might not see any football again.
Yeah, I think it's good that somebody comes out and sort of reminds us of it, right?
Definitely.
Because, you know, you get people saying, the season must continue forever. You get, you know, let's wrap it up come what may. You've got other people, you know, saying, let's play behind closed doors. Let's play in our toilets. But you know what? Ultimately, hey, what if we just take it on the chin and move on? There's another proposal which has been... Just apparently, it's another thing that UEFA are looking at, which would be to... This has been reported in some English media. I personally, from what I understand, this does not have a lot of support, but would be, let's play the end of this season next season, if that makes any sense. In other words, as far as UEFA competitions are concerned, let's go and wrap these up in August, probably end of August, and then start the 2021 European competitions in, I guess, in mid-September or October. Mm. Does that make any sense to you?
I don't know. I think there must be a point where if we can't play until a certain day this season, and I know how hard it will be for Liverpool and their fans and for a lot of other clubs. I get it completely, and it will also create a lot of problems if you void this season. I don't know, Sergio Aguero, for example, doesn't beat Thierry Henry's record of the most goal for a non-British player. You know, all those kind of stuff. I get it. But if there's no football, let's say by September, we can't say like, oh yeah, let's wait a bit more and try to finish the 19-20 season. I think there's a point where it will have to stop. So maybe August could be the last ditch where you said, okay, if we can, we do August and we finish that season then, and then we wait a bit to start the next one. But if by the end of August we still haven't been able to play any football, and again, let's not forget, thousands and thousands of people die everywhere in the world now. Football is the least of our concerns. Yeah. So if we can't play because of health reasons, then so be it. And I know it would be hard for Liverpool to take it, But come on, we can't wait forever until we can play again and finish this season.
There was a really good article by the legendary Jorge Valdano, and if you don't know who he is, you should hang your head in shame. And El País. You saw? Okay, fine. Tell me exactly what it said.
No, I didn't see it. Piece, but I saw that he wrote about it.
No, but he basically said about how this disease makes football confront its own mortality. And he told this wonderful story about a guy who's on a dock, and a little boy falls into the water, and he dives in to save the little boy. He saves the little boy. He brings him back to land. And then, like, a week later, he bumps into little boy's mom, and she says, "Oh, you're the guy who saved my son, the little boy." And he says, "Oh, yes. Is he well?" "Yes, yes, he's well. Thank you so much for saving him. But, by the way, you didn't happen to see..." He was wearing a hat. "You didn't happen to see the hat or recover the hat." And I thought it was pretty telling, because it's almost as if, you know, people need to be shaken awake about the situation we're in. This is very real, all right? So the way we still see people, you know, trying to worry, failing to see the big picture on this, I think is rather telling. But I'll tell you what, I mean, I think their tune's going to change very, very quickly.
Yeah, I agree. And just on suffering, to go back to people, UEFA, and you back me up on that, UEFA can't tell the leagues, "You have to stop now. This season is voided on everything." The league can do whatever they want. But at some point, UEFA would say, "You can play whenever you want. If you want to play in January 2021, the remaining of your current season, do it." But at some point, UEFA would need to register for their European competitions, the team for each country and each league, right?
Exactly. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. A lot of people think, "Oh, UEFA are telling people what to do." And they're really not. They don't know. They don't tell people to do, because they don't know what to do. You know, I think so far they've tried to involve everybody, and they've not been top down. They want to make sure that if they handle this badly, everybody was part of the decision making process and everybody takes the blame, because I think now more than ever, every aspect of football is in it together. But Jules, some hope. Because a bunch of outlets have come up with an idea where we can have our cake and eat it too. And yeah. Mark Ogden's going to join us in a minute. Are you excited?
Very excited.
Look at your that excitement on your face. All right, Jules. So let's move on to what I think would be a fun story, but I suspect that Mark Ogden thinks is a less fun story. Augie. Tell us about this plan. It's been floated in a number of places. It's been talked about in the U.S., possibly with the NBA. Give us the rundown.
Well, like you, I think it's quite a fun story as well, but I just don't think it's workable. I think it's unfeasible. The idea is that the only way to get this season done is to basically move all 20 Premier League teams away from where they are, put them in an isolation camp for 2 weeks, a quarantine camp, so that when they emerge from that, they'll be clear of the virus, I guess, and then they can play the games behind closed doors. So that basically, from going into quarantine and playing the games, it'll be a sterile environment, which it sounds good on the face of it, but let's work out how many people you need to be behind the closed doors.
But before you hit us with your negativity, let's understand the idea better, okay?
Okay. Realism.
Right. No. So basically, why would you need to put them in a sterile environment? Couldn't you just test them?
We can't get a test.
Well, you can't get a test, but I mean, I think, as we've seen, whether you're Idris Elba or Mikel Arteta, you can go online, you can Google a test, and you can buy a test for $200. So that's, and hopefully by June there'll be more tests, right?
You put them in a sterile environment, because if you don't, then you risk every other day another player testing positive, which means they have to quarantine themselves for 7 to 14 days.
I get that. I'm saying, like, you could just test them, and then whoever's clean gets to go and to some sort of training camp, right? This is what the story describes. And they're all sequestered away. I'm assuming it would take, what, like 6 to 8 weeks to go and finish it? There's 92 games left. And the version of the story I saw said that they wouldn't be playing in football grounds. They'd be playing maybe someplace with a lot of training pitches, like St. George's. you could turn it into a huge reality TV show, right?
Yeah, I mean, whether that actually works or not, I mean, that's a broadcasting issue as well, because I guess the broadcasters would have a question mark against that. Can they broadcast live games from a mass playing field like St. George's Park? But even if it is at St. George's Park, it isn't just a case of getting two teams on the pitch. It's not 22 players. It's, you're looking at 36 players straight away for the two squads. The coaching staff of each team is at least 10. If it's Man City, you've got about 30 staff on the pitch. So let's say it's 10. That's 20. That's, you're into 56 already. Then you've got the officials. Then you've got the ground staff. Then you've got technicians. Then you've got video people that will do it for the television or even for data analysis. All of a sudden, it goes over 100 people.
Okay.
Are you going to put over 1,000 people away in isolation for a month?
Well, I think it would probably be closer to between 1,500 and 2,000 people, right?
Yeah, exactly, which is just, it's just a ridiculous number of people. I think it's an idea that the Premier League have to consider, because I think it's been floating in Australia and the A-League as well. But it just sounds the most ridiculous fantasy idea you've ever heard. I mean, I'd imagine that something else will come up rather than this, but if it doesn't, then it's going to be a very strange end to the season.
Jules, I bet you're into this.
I'm not interested. I could not care less. I didn't even read the story. I don't care. Bring me something that people have announced that is official, and then we can discuss if it's a good thing or a bad thing. Those fantasy stories, like Mark put them, whether they might happen or not, they're a good idea for some people, they're a bad idea for other people. I could not care less.
Well, yeah, there's a meeting on Friday, April the 3rd. There's another Premier League conference where they're going to discuss this idea and the idea of pay deferrals. But you're right, Jules, it's a case of the ideas are coming out now because there's no news, there's no sense of, I won't say leadership, but there's no sense of, this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it. Now, clearly it's difficult at the moment because nobody knows when this is going to end, and it's clearly not going to end anytime soon. We heard the Deputy Chief Medical Officer in the UK on Sunday saying, prepare for 6 months. Now, if it's a six-month situation, that's October.
Yeah.
So football in the next 6 months can forget about it if it's October, because I don't see it. The government is not going to say, yeah, you can play football this weekend, but on Monday go back to isolation. And it just doesn't make sense.
Well, okay, so I guess I'll play devil's advocate here, because, I mean, I'm writing about this. I'm totally in two minds. I think there's serious logistical issues with it, obviously. But if we're just going to talk about the principle, we're basically saying that the Premier League clubs are essentially running a big TV show, right? I mean, this is their main source of revenue, is broadcasting, and the visibility that the broadcasting brings. And that, of course, then brings commercial revenue and sponsorship, and people buy shirts and whatever, right? This is a way to keep it going. This is a way for the Premier League clubs to continue making their money. I don't think it's that big a deal necessarily to go and put 1,500 people in a sequestered environment. I mean, you kind of do it for the World Cup, right? Don't you? I mean, you put them all in hotels, and you'd need producers and for the TV bit and whatever. Maybe you could even run a reality TV show alongside it, and, you know, I bet Amazon wouldn't like it, but others could, you know. And you could just put all these people in a big bubble and have them go and perform for us, like hamsters on a wheel.
But maybe they play every day. You know what, one thing that really winds me up about this whole situation is that you hear stories of players aren't happy about having to play, you know, three games in a week, and they might get injured. Footballers sometimes have to look at the bigger picture. If playing three times a week in this situation is a bad thing, then come on. You know, they have to get real. Everybody's having to make sacrifices right now, and everyone's having to lose something or change something. If footballers want to stick to this idea of, oh, you know, two games a week's enough and we can't play twice in 48 hours, well, they may have to. They may have to do it.
So you don't have...
I mean, if that's what happens, can you imagine how sad it would be? Have City United playing at St. George's Park, and this is not like an under-15 freaking tournament.
No.
Where you just go, and then, like, you know, and then you've got another game just behind, and when you watch one, you can see the players on the other pitch.
Jules, you obviously haven't seen The Mandalorian. So, between green screens and CGI effects...
Yeah, I'm sure. That's the football we like.
You know what? I bet there's some nerd out there who's going to tell me that you could do this. You could have them play at St. George's Park, and it could you could make it look like Anfield. And no, the games wouldn't be all taking place at the same time.
No, you can't. No, you can't do that. You can't do that.
You should do it. When I was a kid, and you guys remember the same, you play these games on a Saturday and a Sunday, and you probably play three games a day. Let's do it that way. If you want to have a bit of fun, Gab, let's make it like Big Brother. Let's make up some challenges.
Yeah, what about playing seven aside is cool. Shorter version of the game.
The girl that wins Liverpool the league title is scored in front of.
Yeah, rush goalie as well. Let's do rush goalie.
Okay. One man and his dog.
Alisson would be good at rush goalie. Can you imagine Alisson at rush goalie?
I'm going to try to put a little bit of sense of this. I am not as opposed to the idea as you guys are. Not for those reasons, anyway. I'm opposed to it for the following reasons. I mean, number one, this is a solution for the Premier League. This is not a solution which would help the Football League in any way, shape, or form. Because you would still have the issue that, you know, those clubs can't do this, right? Because nobody's going to pay to watch, Rotherham against Salford. You're probably going to tell me they're in different divisions.
Yeah, different divisions.
They're just avatars for northern things. Secondly, those teams obviously rely on gate receipts, right? So no gate receipts, you're not going to make any money. You'd still have the problem of promotion and relegation, because if you can't play out the championship, then yeah, maybe you can send Norwich down, but you don't know who's going to come up. I think the other big problem is, and this is the part which actually angers me, and I'm going to wear my my trade unionist hat, since Gordon Taylor's obviously not wearing his. Who do they think they are that they get off on sequestering players for 2 months in June and July, stick them in a hotel? I would hope players refuse to do this. I would hope some players refuse to do this, because it's absolutely freaking ridiculous that you're going to go and put these people in prison away. By the way, when you're talking about sequestering, you're talking 1,500, 2,000 people. That means no families, no loved ones, nothing, right?
And hotel staff, can they go home? Have they got to stay there as well? Because if they go home and come back,
Hotel staff, they're just servants anyway, right? They're just slaves to the machine, right? So of course the hotel staff stay there. Or maybe actually, if you want to make it more fun, you just have a TV crew there and you make the players cook their own meals.
That would be kind of cool. And make their own beds.
I mean, it's unfair to players, it's unfair to club staff. It all needs to be discussed. The other obvious factor, too, is I think we've been around enough 20, especially the younger players. These are the people who, when they stay in a 5-star luxury hotel during a World Cup and they only get to see their family, you know, once every 5 days for conjugal visits, they freak out, right? That's the whole reason, right? Fabio Capello was a baddie in 2010. You guys all killed him because he tried to run a modicum of discipline.
It was like Alcatraz, though, that place.
I'm sure it was. I'd love to send some of these guys, maybe some media, to Alcatraz, and we can make a comparison. How the hell are you going to do this for 6 to 8 weeks? You know these people are going to sneak out. You know it's going to happen. Or they'll sneak people in.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I'm just being realistic here, right?
You are. And you know what? I think if that's the direction, I think then it would increase the amount of people who actually would rather the season to stop now and probably be void than having to finish it in that way.
Why don't this play tell each team to play three more fixtures? I mean, it's not ideal, but if they played three more games, it would give them a chance to improve their position or get out of relegation trouble, and it would give them an opportunity to change their season.
No, it's not. It's not going to give it. This is where you're showing your anti-Man City bias. Three games isn't enough for Manchester City to win the title.
True. We can't play. Well, 33 games might be able to help Man City win the title this season, because Liverpool have got it in the bag. But we're not going to get 92 games played. It's just not feasible. In the real world, as you see today, where we can't even go out of our house for more than, you know, for a mile or two for a walk, you're not going to be able to play football in the next 2 or 3 months, I don't think.
I think what we need to start thinking about is, and I know this is going to sound really harsh and callous and whatever, if we can't play again, what we need to start thinking about, we need to start thinking about what the owners care about. And that is purely one thing, and that is money, right? Reach some mediated solution. Reach some solution where you go to Norwich and you say, hey, Norwich, guess what? You're going to be relegated. And Leeds United, you're coming up. But to make this fair, you guys negotiate. Here is the pot of money. And we're going to make it worth your while to accept relegation. We're going to make it worth your while to accept promotion. I mean, you need to come up with some formula like that. So if people get relegated or promoted, there's enough money taken out of the system to alleviate the sting. I think that ultimately is going to be the only way we solve this without lawsuits or with minimal lawsuits. All these freaking mid-table clubs that are just along for the ride, make everybody give up £10 million from what they earn this season, put it in a pot, and use it as compensation for those who are going to be slighted because they won't be given a chance to get out of the relegation zone or to get promoted, and let them figure it out. If you're Leeds United, would you rather have £150 million or would you rather be promoted? If you're Norwich, would you rather stay up or would you rather have £150 million plus the parachute payments plus all the other nonsense you get in the Championship? Can we reach a deal that way? I think it's going to have to come to that.
No one would rather go down than
staying up. That's a tough one.
Norwich would never say, well, yeah, we would rather go down, even with all that money, than staying up. Surely. So they would always advocate for, well, let's have the season voided.
I know. Well, first of all, they may not get a chance. So, you know, we may end up telling them, you'll like it, Norwich. But secondly,
but how do you tell Man United in fifth place that you'll have to like it? You're not qualified for the Champions League. You're fifth, Chelsea are fourth, like it. Because telling Man United that is different to telling Norwich City that in terms of
Man United would go to the Champions League because they'd find some excuse to screw over City and then could send United to the Champions League. I got that part covered. So there's no issue there. But I think, look, in the end, at some point, it's going to come down to money because that is what keeps clubs afloat and that is what owners ultimately care about. And you know what, Jules, there is a number at which if you're Norwich, considering that I'm sure all their players have relegation clauses and whatnot, where they look at it and say, all right, this number for us makes sense to go down, and the same thing for Leeds United to go up. Or maybe it doesn't make sense.
But it's not just about the money, Gab. It's the fact that you're a Premier League side. You play in the Premier League. You don't play in the Championship. By the way, the Championship, you never know when you're going to come back again.
Well, look at Leeds. It's taken 16 years to get in this position.
Why would Norwich say that? Okay, yeah, give us 150 million or 200 million, and then we're happy to go down.
Well, simply because you either negotiate an agreement that everybody settles on, whatever it is, maybe Norwich stay up, maybe Leeds say, all right, we'll take cash and we won't come up, or whatever. You either negotiate an agreement, or you end up with a solution that leaves everybody unhappy, which is either voiding the season, which I think you'll have some very angry Liverpool fans, or possibly saying, okay, the season's over, this is the final table, which you'll still have unhappy Norwich fans if you do that, because they're going to go down if they're in the relegation zone. If we can't play again, you have to come up with some kind of solution. Right, I think this is the least worst solution if you can't play again. If you got something better, Jules, let's hear it. Come on, hit me.
No, you're right. I mean, no.
I'm right. Here you go.
This is part of the debate. No, I don't have anything better. Would you still give the title to Liverpool and then just keep those 20 teams in the Premier League for next season? So Leeds and West Brom and Fulham and all those teams in the Championship, you say, sorry guys, you had a great season.
You work it out. You negotiate.
You can't go up. You can't go up. We can't finish the season.
Well, you null and void the season, and then in 6 months before the next season starts, say, Norwich, Leeds, West Brom, Aston Villa, you play in a playoff, and the two teams that come out of it, you promoted.
Okay, so then, but is that fair? Because Leeds have said, well, we're going to finish in the automatic promotion spot.
But Leeds fall apart. As we know, that Leeds are falling apart again as a song, so Leeds may fall apart and finish third. So they might take it as an opportunity.
We had a lot of scenarios. Mark, give us a little preview about Friday before, and this meeting Friday before we let you go.
Yeah, and Friday.
Also, tell me this. Given, I was talking to somebody at a Premier League club who may or may not be a chairman. And
I know who you talk to.
And he said, look, if we had David Dean and Richard Scudamore directly involved, we would have much more clarity and we would all be going in the right direction. Unfortunately, David Dean is now in irrelevance. Scudamore is fading into the background. Do you think that, I mean, is Richard Masters, is he going to be able to get the Premier League to speak with one voice and agree with anything the way Scudamore used to be able to do?
No, because like you said, there are no kind of big beasts in that room anymore. You know, David Dean was a guy that everyone respects, or certainly people feared him rather than respect him in some aspects. You know, Daniel Levy has that similar status, but I don't think he's as universally respected or liked as David Dean was.
Well, isn't Scudamore still on like a Premier League consultant of some kind?
Yeah, he's still cashing in.
Can they bring him back to
Well, I guess they could do, but that would instantly undermine the new guy, Richard Masters, wouldn't it? If the new boss has to go to his old boss and say, what am I supposed to do to sort this out? I don't think that's a feasible, workable option. Well, but you're right in terms of there's too many vested interests. There's no unifying, you know, candidate. Everyone has different agendas. The big six have a different agenda to the lower 14, you might want to call it. I don't know. But it's, so Friday's meeting is about, look, ultimately, it's just another case of a talking shop as to how we get out of this mess. But one issue that is on the table is, pay deferrals and how to sustain themselves. And as we've spoken about this before, Gab, that Premier League clubs are probably wealthy enough to ride this out for a good period yet, but everyone else is taking pay cuts and pay deferrals, so I guess that'll be high on the agenda.
Well, I myself am looking forward to the giant reality TV show in the Midlands, and in fact, I'm pretty sure that if you can apply for media accreditation to go, and there'll be a media hotel where we all can be sequestered in, and maybe we'll do the podcast from there. Love. Won't that be fun?
Can't wait.
Cheers, Augie.
Cheers, guys.
Jules, it's that part of the show which our producer, Freddie, has dubbed, and you can tell he's a very imaginative, creative guy.
Of course.
He's dubbed it Alphabet 11.
Amazing.
Now, I'm assuming we'll use the English alphabet for this, obviously, so we won't, you know, we won't use, like, the weird Spanish double L or some of those Turkish letters with a B.
Yeah, not even A and E and...
Like, yeah, that. Exactly, you know, yeah, the Norwegian there. But for those who haven't been paying attention, it's every week we ask you to come up with your World 11 of current players whose last name or name by which they're best known starts with that letter of the alphabet. And this week, our Sesame Street letter of the day is the letter C.
It's the letter C. And I have to say, you guys who listen to us, you're absolutely legends, because you send loads of your teams on Twitter, both to Gavin and my account and the ESPNFC account. So we've picked a few. Obviously, you've got a lot of names that come back, like Carvajal at right back and Courtois in goal, but sometimes you've got a few variations. So, for example, we've got Ruben Daniel Zavala, who sent a good team. Courtois in goal. Back four of Carvajal and Chilwell, two fullbacks. Chiellini and Christensen, two of your favourite in centre-backs. Casemiro and Camavinga in the centre midfield. And then Coman, Cazorla, Callejon and Cavani up front, which is a pretty strong team, to be fair. Alexander Mendes has a similar back five, exactly the same, then Casemiro as well. But he plays 4-3-3, and ahead of Casemiro, he's got Emre Can and Castrovilli from Fiorentina, who's a very, very good shot that we both like. And then the front three of Callejon, Cavani, and Coman. What about Canadian Romelu? He plays with a diamond midfield. Oh, you're going to like that. You're going to like that. I mean, he's got Choluca as a centre-back.
Well, what is he? Is he related to Choluca?
He must be.
I didn't even know the guy still plays. Where does he play?
He does for Lokomotiv. Yes, I think.
Okay,
I mean, yeah, I know. He's got Dani Ceballos in midfield with Chan and Casemiro. And then he's got Coutinho as a number 10, free roll. Probably his best position, to be fair.
Ceballos and Coutinho together with just the one ball? You sure? Okay.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good point. And then Cavani and Diego Costa up front. Interesting.
I just point out, Cavani and Diego Costa is like a total sort of like, you know, God and Satan together, or better yet, Jesus and Jeffrey Dahmer. No, it's like the ultimate bad guy with the guy who looks like Jesus without a beard, right?
Yes, it's a bit like that. I like that. I like your comparison.
Okay.
We've got one from France, Mathias Sossed, who sent Courtois in goal, back three of Carvajal, Clichy, and Khalid Takar, the Marseille.
Can I point something out? Okay. I nearly had Khalid Takar in my team. I don't want to give anything away. But this is the back three from France, right? Part of the reason you guys struggle with some of these concepts, and I've explained this to people, and France is weird because you've got a lot of people who are way into football and really understand football. But then obviously the majority of the country are fans of other sports like rugby, cycling, or smoking. So, how do you put Clichy and Danny Carvajal in your back three?
This is what Cruyff would have done. You basically leave Khalid Takar because he's so good, pretty much on his own, and then
so
Clichy and Carvajal
could
be like those new modern fullbacks / centre-backs / whatever you want. Then you've got Camavinga and Casemiro to secure that midfield. That's good. Coman, Correa, I guess it's Angel Correa, and then Ryan Cherki, the French prodigy from Lyon, and then Cavani and Calvert-Lewin up front. I like Manchester's team.
All right, okay.
A couple more. We've got Ibes 16, Cillessen in goal.
Come on, you lost me right there. Jesus, okay.
Sorry, Ibes 16. Okay. What about this one? Carvajal at right back, Chilwell at left back. Connor Cody, double C, by the way. Good on him. He's in my team as well.
You get bonus points for that.
Yeah, and Chiellini there. I mean, nah, forget about him. He put Cristiano there. I mean, come on.
No.
Come on. Samuel Bravo. Come on. Okay, last one. I'm going to go for this one. This is a good one. For Mark O'Brien, Courtois in goal. Kappa right back from Athletic Bilbao. Diego Carlos from Sevilla, formerly at Nantes. And Connor Cody in centre-backs. Cucurella, the Barca player on loan at Getafe, one of the revelations of the season in La Liga, at left-back. Casemiro and Emre Can. Angel Correa. Canales, who we all loved when he was a kid. And
when he was 16 and we found out he wasn't quite that good, but yeah, okay.
Douglas Costa, and then Cavani up front.
All right, now, do we have a submission of a women's 11 too? Now, we encourage you, I am way out of my wheelhouse. This is not my expertise, but our pal and colleague Sophie Lawson submitted one for the A's. We got one for the C's?
We've got one indeed from Miguel Galan, who lives in Mexico, I believe. Well done to you, Miguel, and that's a pretty cool team. In goal, you've got Catacol, the Spanish goalkeeper. Then you've got a back four of Ellie Carpenter, Viola Caligaris, Rachel Corsi, and Steph Catley. Pretty strong back four. Then you've got my favorite, Delphine Cascarino, as the right player in that midfield four. Erin Cuthbert, the Scottish player. Dana Castellanos and Marta Cardona from Spain as well. And then the front two of Christian from Brazil. And then Tabitha Chawinga as well, which is, Miguel, a very strong C team, you have to say.
Very impressive, very impressive. Now, I know you're dying to hear my team, aren't you?
Yeah, go on.
Okay, I'm slightly disappointed because I wanted to be a little bit different. But
yeah, of course.
So, I've gone with Thibaut Courtois at the back because there's no argument there.
Yeah.
Dani Carvajal again. I didn't think there were that many good left backs. I tried to come up with somebody slightly more original where I liked more than Chilwell. I did consider Gael Clichy, but then he's got a girl's name. So
he's my team.
I figured he'd be in your team. center backs.
So who's your left back? Who's your left back?
Ben Chilwell.
Well, okay, you've went for the two fullbacks that everybody has. Basically.
Yeah, it's fine. Hopefully you got a little bit better. This is a little more okay, limiting here, right? I went with my man Giorgio Chiellini because, you know, the guy's got a law degree and a very large nose and he's a warrior. And he is the typical player who people hated when he was younger and then now that he's old, people tend to like again. I wonder if it's going to happen with Sergio Ramos. I'm guessing no. And then, of course, your buddy Caleta Carr at the back. Now, in midfield, Emre Can, Camavinga, and of course, the phenom that is Castrovilli. Gotta be Gaetano Castrovilli, of course. Now, because I always try to get as many viable Fiorentina players in the team as possible, up front, part of the front three, gotta be Federico Chiesa, obviously. Yep. On the opposite wing from Chiesa, because I like balance. Why? Who better than Jesus Corona, right? In these ancient times. You've got to have the Mexico's finest player named after a beer. Yeah. Of course, Corona also, you know the story about how Corona was known as Tecatito before that, right? You know why and stuff. It's a brilliant story. I'm going to assume all the listeners know. If you don't know why, do some Googling or hit Jules up or me on social media and we'll tell you. And then, of course, up front, why, who else but Shaven Jesus, Edinson Cavani.
That's pretty good. I like it a lot. Okay, this is mine. I play in a 4-3-3 formation like you. I've got Courtois in goal, no debate. I've got Celik, the Turkish international right-back from Lille, who is a very, very good young player to come through. I've got Gael Clichy, a left-back, my brother, of course.
Your brother from another mother, yeah.
Exactly. Okay. And then my centre-backs are Chiellini, of course, and Connor Cody, as we said, double C as well. He deserves to be there. My midfield three, Castrovilli. I'm with you all the way. Great future ahead of him. Camavinga, because he's
great,
just...
minds think alike.
Yeah, you're right. And then I've got Santi Cazorla, because for me, coming back from where he was, he's the good gap. I mean, the guy had like, what, 9 surgery on his Achilles. They had to take some skins off his arm to pull down his
foot. I defer to you on this. It really should be Santi Cazorla. I really struggled because, you know, I struggled with the whole German thing about, you know, too many German players, not enough German players. I didn't want to seem like I was being mean and, like, not having any Bundesliga players in there. So I said,
I know.
But no, Cazorla is a much, much better pick. I tip my hat to you, sir.
Yeah, Santi, and he's one of the most loveliest guys you would ever meet in football. So Santi there.
He's
and
a warrior of the light.
Yeah. And front three of Kingsley Coman. You know, for me, obviously, and Paris born and bred kid. Douglas Costa. And then you know who I've got as number 9, yeah? You know who I've got.
Edinson?
Cavani!
All right, brilliant. I can't argue with that. I think that'd be pretty impressive. I don't like having Douglas Costa and Kingsley Coman. I think...
Flip-flop King on one side and then the pace on the other. It's brilliant.
Don't you find it deeply unsettling that your team has, what, 3 current or former Juve players on it? I don't quite know about that. But still, we're going to go through with this. We're going to go on with this next week, too. And can you exclusively reveal, big news now, Jules, I would like you to exclusively reveal to our audience which letter of the alphabet we'll be doing next week. Now, pay close attention.
It
may not be what you expect.
Exactly. Drum roll. The letter D.
D for David. Yes, that's right.
D for David, indeed. Send us all your suggestions on Twitter to ESPNFC, to Gab, to me. And then we pick the best ones and we pick them on the show on Thursday.
I want to see if I can make a whole team of Danilos. All right, Jules, as much fun as the C-Team 11 was, we got to move on to some quick hits.
Let's go.
Karim Benzema compared himself to a Formula One car and Olivier Giroud to a go-kart on Sunday night. I like to think it was one of those, like, you know, like those, oh God, what are they called? Those little box car things that, like, they race down. Anyway, Jules, remind us of the backstory to these two and the wider context of the French national team and Didier Deschamps. And maybe if you were revising Olivier Giroud, who, let's face it, is far more handsome than Karim Benzema, give him some ideas on how to respond.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he will respond. I mean, for me, as much as I like Karim Benzema, and I know you're a big fan as well, this is like primary school playground stuff. Like, there was no need for Karim Benzema. He was doing a live Instagram or Snapchat chat with a YouTuber or someone like that, an influencer from Marseille. And they talked about a lot of things. And at some point, he talked about Giroud. And then Karim went like, oh, let's not get confused between a Formula One, which is me, and a go-kart. After that, to be fair to Benzema, he went on and said that Giroud had done some great things with the national team, with France, got to a point. But that whole comparison of, like, I'm a Formula One car, he's a go-kart, basically means that Benzema has always thought, since he was dropped by Deschamps, and let's not forget, because of the sex tape with Mathieu Valbuena and how much Karim Benzema and his friends...
Should we be very clear on this? About the sex tape with Benzema and Valbuena. It's not actually Benzema and Valbuena doing sexual things with each other on the sex tape, yeah? No, because some people might not be familiar with this.
It's Mathieu Valbuena and a girl.
Okay.
And then the video leaked somewhere, and Karim Benzema and some of his friends allegedly tried to intervene, let's put it that way, which cost Karim Benzema his place with the national team, with France. He was dropped, and so was Mathieu Valbuena, to be fair. And I think Benzema feels that Giroud took his place and that Deschamps stuck with Giroud and never called back Benzema, regardless of how good Benzema has been in the recent few years. And that's where the feud comes from, and that's where the feud still is.
Okay, but Benzema is really just messing, okay? So, like...
But that was still childish. He should be above that.
He's bored. He's at home. Leave layoff.
But still, you know, still. I still think he didn't cover himself in glory there, I have to say. Well, Juventus, on the other hand, did something much better than what Benzema did. He issued a press release saying that players and manager are giving up 4-month wages, so that's around 90 million euros in light of the current pandemic. Gab, this is the biggest wage reduction yet from any major club anywhere in Europe.
Yeah, it is. Now they're giving them up. They could get some of the monies back if they start playing. It's a big step. What's kind of odd is they sort of discussed this with the captains, Chiellini, Bonucci, Buffon. They reached a deal. They haven't quite negotiated with all the players individually about this and gotten the buy-in from all the players. It's obviously a voluntary pay cut. So you assume that they're pretty confident that they'll be able to hit that target of 90 million. But I think, you know, some of the details remain to be ironed out. Look, it's a big step. I think in Juventus's case, they were probably a little bit more exposed on this front when you look at some of the recent numbers. And I think it shows that the players are willing to go along. And by the way, you don't need me to tell you who is going to lose the most money out of all this. Cristiano Ronaldo, I worked out that this will end up costing him. So given that he makes round about 65 million, 63 million euros a year, this is going to cost Cristiano personally about 20 million euros, which I think is more than like basically his own personal wages that he's going to give up, you know, if he subscribes to this,
agrees, yeah.
I'm sure he will be more than like some entire leagues will give up. It just kind of gives you a bit of the scope and the context of Cristiano.
Yeah.
Now, I've always pointed out that maybe we shouldn't be so panicky about lost income until broadcasters actually stop making payments or demand their money back. Jules, we've had the first greedy broadcaster in France, Canal Plus, demanding their money back.
Yeah, you're right. Canal Plus was supposed, or are still supposed, to do to pay one of their installment for the TV rights to the French league and the French clubs on April the 5th, and that's around 110 million euros. And they've said, do you know what? There's no games there. We're not showing any games, not broadcasting anything, so we're not going to pay anything. And that's right, because we paid for rights, we paid to broadcast games, and they're not happening. So what would we pay? Which obviously, as you said, we sort of thought and anticipated that a few TV channels or, you know, broadcaster groups, media groups would do that. But this is really the first one who go first and said, hang on, you're not going to get your money. Clubs are not going to get their part of it. And again, that starts what we see in other countries. That starts a bit of a war between leagues and TV broadcasters and between clubs and TV broadcasters. What do? Do you sue them? Do you put pressure on them? Do you wait? And of course, if those games end up being played at some point, Canal Plus will pay. But right now they're saying, we're not paying. And the problem is, if the season is stopped and finished and terminated and void, Canal Plus are not going to pay for those games that haven't been played. And that would be a huge loss for all those clubs.
And of course, everything is then complicated by the fact that Canal Plus lost the contract for the next cycle to another company as well. So they could also be saying, well, why we need to spend money and to promote Ligue 1 and keep going this way if we're not going to reap the benefits down the road. It's a pretty messy situation.
It is indeed. Well, Xavi turned down the possibility of rejoining Barcelona as manager this time a few months ago, you remember, but now says that he would be willing to come back, provided that the atmosphere at the club wasn't too toxic and that he had the right conditions to be his job as manager. Gab, what does that mean exactly? And are you surprised of the timing, maybe, of his interview?
Nah, he's on lockdown like the rest of us. He's got time on his hands. I know people love to see, you know, big conspiracies on the back of the Barcelona reduction and stuff like that, what was agreed. But I think the only issue timing-wise is he's potentially setting himself up possibly for the next presidential election, which, I mean, at one point looked as if it was going to be moved forward to this summer. It's not going to happen now. It's going to be 2021, quite obviously. But I think, you know, when he talks toxic atmosphere, he wants not these recriminations, not some of these mysterious deals that seem to have been green-lighted. I'm not just referring to Trincao, obviously. Mm-hmm. He wants some clarity and he wants some power, and he's not going to come back unless he's guaranteed that. I think what Xavi most of all does not want to do, he does not want to be somebody's tool. He does not want to be you know, somebody's fig leaf saying like, oh, look, you know, I brought back Xavi, and because he's an ex-legend, he loves the club, he's always right. We've seen other clubs do that, maybe, you know, bring ex-players back and just put them in the, shove them in the limelight, knowing that they won't be attacked because they're legends, and shielding themselves with it. And, you know, any reference to Manchester United is purely coincidental there. But I said Manchester United, I could have said Juventus with Ciro Ferrara. There's many others. Yeah. Xavi's not going to be used that way. And good for him. Now, Jules, I'm totally confused by this story. So please tell me the story of the white Range Rover, the slipper on one foot, and the slider. For those who don't know, sliders are these horrible plastic, I suppose, like flip-floppy type
flip-flops,
things.
Flip-flops, yeah. That football players wear.
Football players wear, yeah. And also a man who may or may not be Jack Grealish. This story is so weird.
Strange story this weekend where it seems like Jack Grealish, who is supposed, like all of us, to be in confinement, in self-isolation, decided to went to one of his friends' houses to do whatever they do together. I don't know, play PlayStation maybe, but certainly have a bit of a drink, because he looked like very early in the morning he was leaving his friend's house drunk. Let's be fair, let's be honest, that's how he looks like, at least, with one slider and one slipper, you're right, on each feet, and then drove off in his white Range Rover and smashed the car onto cars that were already parked on the street, and then fled the scene. So we can just assume that it was Jack Grealish. It looked like certainly his car.
We're not sure 100%
that he was driving
this.
The car, but it looks like it, right?
Okay, well, Jack Grealish has been seen driving a white Range Rover to training sessions at Aston Villa. Yeah. We don't know if it's the same white Range Rover. We don't know if it's Jack Grealish's car. We don't know if Jack Grealish was driving it.
No, but so, it looks like it is.
The weirdo in the slider-slipper combination is a guy who looks like Jack Grealish.
No, it might be Jack Grealish. That is Jack Grealish, trust me. That is
we don't know when that picture was taken. Maybe it was taken 6 months ago when Jack Grealish decides to get up early in the morning wearing one slipper and one slider, right?
Right, so, although he's wearing a Givenchy hoodie.
These people, man.
Sky blue, which I think are quite recent, so, you know.
So Coventry City colours, then.
But listen, you know what? Even if it's not him, it's not him, and we apologise, and everybody apologise. Even if it's not him, this is not good publicity. This is bad on him. Even if it's not him, you know, he's always the one with kind of stuff like that. And that's not good, especially at a time where, you know, you should be respectful of, of the
other. You can't have it both ways. You say if it's not him, it's not good publicity. Well, if it's not him, it's not good publicity for whatever Burke drove his white Range Rover
into
his car.
It doesn't matter. He still his name in it. You know, like, this is not what he, you know. Right. As far as I know, Gab, and I'm looking for football to watch live, but even that I can't watch. I'm sorry. I mean, no offense to Belarus and Nicaragua, but come on. But yeah, Nicaragua League and the Belarusian League seems to be the only two leagues still going on at the moment. Are they sort of magically immune, or what's going on there?
I don't know. The Nicaragua League, I haven't seen, I haven't gotten video of this. If I were the, if I was a broadcaster, I'd buy the rights anyway. But one of the guys who plays there was interviewed by in Spain, and he talked about how, like, and you might have seen the picture of how, like, they played with little surgical masks on while wearing gloves. The guy said, yeah, I ran around with a stupid surgical mask about 20 minutes. I was out of breath. I just took it off. In Belarus, there's a good story on our website by a colleague, Artur Petrosian, who got a lot of details, spoke to a lot of people. What's going on in Belarus is pretty wild. I mean, the crowds are down. Lukashenko, the president and supreme leader, you know, he says, like, well, you know, we've got cold weather, drink vodka, physical exercise is good for you.
Go in saunas as well. He said vodka and sauna and we'll get out of this virus crisis. I mean, come on.
I think, you know, the best possible way to get out of this is if you get a bunch of dudes packed closely together in a sauna while drinking vodka for several hours. I think that will, like, I don't know. You know, we can joke about it. I hope people stay safe. What I do know, and this is mentioned in the articles, is people in Belarus and Nicaragua know what's going on, right? they know the risks involved, so hopefully they're not putting themselves at risk, and hopefully they're following grown-up advice.
Imagine they're drinking vodka in the same glass as well, by the way.
Yes, exactly. Please share the shot glass. Now, Jules, on a different note, Abdel Haq Nouri, he's been out of a coma. He's been back home for some time. He was in the news this weekend. It turns out he could be awarded 4.5 million euros from Ajax because the treatment he received was deemed to be inadequate. I know, obviously, you've been following the story closely. Give us the background and give us where we are.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to focus more on the fact that the Nouri sort of came out of the coma more than why he could get the money from Ajax. But it's true, like you said, that if it apparently that the treatment first he received after he fainted and went into coma more than 3 years, a bit less than 3 years ago now, was deemed not adequate, and that's where the money could come from, or the reason why the money could be paid for. But the fact that we all thought at the time, and if you remember, the emotion was quite incredible 3 years ago for someone who was only a very, very promising and talented young player, but still a young player. It's not like if he had played 500 games for the first team and won loads of trophies. But yet, the wave of emotion all around Europe and in the world, not just in Holland, was just incredible. And all the tributes were fantastic. And now he's come out of the coma. He can move his eyes and his eyebrows to sort of communicate with his family, which is quite incredible. And it's a wonderful story of hope, especially in the current situation and what we're living, what we're going through now, all as the world. It's an incredible story of hope and never giving up and always keeping that faith alive that something positive could come, because there's time where clearly people thought that he would not come out on the other side. So it's a slow and small progression, if you want, or things like that, but it's incredible. And Frankie de Jong told that story at the weekend, and I'm not sure if it's completely true or not, but it's still a wonderful story that when he was trying to make his mind up about going to PSG or to Barcelona last season when he was at Ajax, and he went to see Nouri and his mum in the hospital or in the house and talked about it with the mum, and when the mum said to Nouri, "My son, where do you think Frankie should go?" And when Barcelona was mentioned, apparently Nouri sort of raised his eyebrow, and Frankie de Jong knew that was the choice for him, and he decided to go to Barcelona to PSG. And again, I think that's a wonderful story, and I really hope that one day when Nouri fully wakes up and can fully talk maybe or something, can be aware that Frankie and him will reminisce that story. Ryan, finally, Gab, I mean, I don't know where to go with that story, I'm sorry, but we have a story on our website, on ESPNFC.com, about this guy called Satawat Setakorn, who owns more David Beckham boots than anybody else, maybe than even Beckham himself in the world. I mean, I wanted to ask you about Harry Kane and his comments on Sunday, which I thought were incredible, but instead, you asked me to ask you about that, so go on then. Go on.
No, I'll give you a special two-for-one. I'll give you a special two-for-one. I'll get to Harry Kane in a minute. This guy, Setawat Setakorn, he's a guy who... Now, these aren't just David Beckham boots. These are match-worn David Beckham boots. So David Beckham's little foot has been in each one of these. He owns more than 400 different items of match-worn memorabilia. I think mostly outerwear, as far as I understand it, not underwear and the like, because that'd be kind of gross. But who knows? Maybe he owns that too. He's got about 30 pairs of Beckham boots. And we've got a whole piece with photos on our website. It's a bit of a different story. You may not like it.
No, that's fine.
You may not be interested in this. But lots of people are.
You know, I know a lot of people who are in love with David Beckham. You know, good on him. How much money has he spent over all those items? You know,
I do not remember. Go check out the story. It's on our website. It's not just about money.
Talk
it's
to about me
about one
Harry,
man's
man.
Love for David Beckham's feet and footwear. And let's leave it there. Let's talk about Harry Kane, right? If we go from foot fetishism...
What's going on, man? The guy's gone crazy or what?
Harry Kane is the opposite of foot fetish, right?
Yeah.
He is the anti-foot fetish made flesh. I got no problem with Harry Kane. You obviously found it was extraordinary. I like it when people are honest.
No, me too, but it's unusual, right? It's unusual, someone of his caliber going out like this and said, hang on, if the team is not good, if it's not the right direction we're going to, I'm off from here. I love this club, but I'm off.
he also said, I love this club. I hope to stay. I want to win medals here sooner rather than later. I don't know. I wonder if maybe it's as simple as the fact that I assume Harry Kane is in self-isolation like the rest of us on lockdown. He's further away from his manager and his manager's advice and from, you know, the club's comms people. So maybe he's a little more honest than he sometimes is. And rather than swerving the question, you know, he gave an honest answer and a direct answer. He also came out and he said he thinks that the season should be voided, right? Or, sorry, if he thinks that you shouldn't play past a certain point, you should start over. He's perfectly right on that. Others, however, might come out and say, well, it's not in Spurs' interest because we could still get in the top four and Harry shut up. Good for Harry Kane. I find him extremely likable. I found him honest. Plus, Harry Kane will always have a special place in my heart because he and I share the same birthday. All right, time to wrap it up.
Yes, see you on Thursday with a new show. Plenty of stuff to talk about. And the D-Team. Let's not forget to send your suggestions.
The D-Team, yes, as the Alphabet 11 continues. Till then, bye-bye.
Stay safe.